This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com. This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
You'd think with a crime scene this brutal, blood splattered across floors, defensive wounds stacked on top of stab wounds, and a full-on brawl in Zanna Kernodle's bedroom, you'd walk away with more than just one lonely piece of DNA on a knife sheath. But here we are. In this episode, we're diving into the chaos that was the crime scene at 1112 King Road and the eerie digital emptiness left in Brian Koberger's wake. And helping us sort through the debris, both literal and investigative, is someone who's been on the inside in scenes like this. Retired FBI Special Agent Jennifer Coffendaffer. What you're about to hear is a reckoning, not a hit piece on law enforcement. Let's be clear, they caught the guy. But a reality check. How secure was that scene, really? How much evidence did we lose in those crucial early hours before the crime lab ever stepped foot inside that house? When friends are walking through blood, picking up potential murder weapons and saying, "Hey, I found a knife." You have to wonder, how locked down was it in the scene of chaos and the fog of war that ensued? Then there's a digital black hole. No texts, no DMs, no creepy messages to Kaylee or Maddie. Just nothing. And they also think Papa Rogers is not him. I tend to disagree with that. Coffendaffer walks us through how someone erases that kind of footprint and why it's so rare to see it done this effectively. Koberger didn't just wipe his tracks. He may have been scrubbing in real time, deleting searches as he went, using software designed to outpace investigators. If that knife sheath hadn't slipped out of his hands, we might still be looking for him. So today we're asking the uncomfortable questions. Was the scene mishandled? Did they miss critical evidence? And just how close did this guy come to getting away with it? Let's get into it. You had said just a few minutes earlier, basically what they released is what they had. What else were you expecting to see? What else did you think they were going to come out with in terms of evidence against Koberger that they were holding back for trial?
Man, I tell you, I'm surprised there's not more at that crime scene. Mm-hmm. I thought, you know, just with the struggle that we know happened with Zanna, they describe it as an intense struggle that took place in that room. They talk about spatter. They talk about the smearing. We still don't know yet who smeared what. Mm-hmm. Does that mean Koberger took his gloved hand and, you know, was wiping it off because it was so drenched in blood? Does that mean Zanna smeared as she crawled? We don't know the details, but we know it was a huge struggle. And with that, even though he was donned with, you know, a lot of protective equipment over his face, his shirt and everything and so forth, I'm still surprised nothing else, with no sweat that would have came from his face, no blood, no other skin cell DNA anywhere from the fight, from the struggle. So I always thought that there was a good possibility we would see him leave some of himself behind, an eyebrow hair.
Yeah.
And I'm being serious.
Yeah.
You know, some sort of hair. You just can't enter a scene, typically Lockhart's theory, you just can't enter and not leave and not take with you. And it seems he magically went in there in some respects and he left his DNA, but I thought there might be more.
Well, I mean, I guess the question is, I mean, you can leave it, but it also has to be found as well. And certainly they were in there combing through that scene. There was a lot of people that were coming and going initially from the scene, especially when the friends came and found all of this. But I mean, how secure of a scene was it? When we look back on this, you know, did they look thorough enough? And I'm not trying to question, I'm not trying to insult, so nobody take me that way. I think, you know, the investigators, they got him and they knew much more than we knew early on. So I'm not trying to be critical. I'm just trying to retrospectively look at this and go, was there, I mean, did they clear the scene too quickly? Was there more investigation, more digging that should have been done forensically at that scene than was?
Well, again, such a good point, because now we know from this police report, one of the boys picked up a knife and walked in and said, "Hey, there's a knife. I found a knife." Like, put it back.
Mm-hmm.
So what else did they possibly touch? We know footprints would have been all throughout there. You see what I mean? They were leaving parts of themselves that I'm sure were found and they had to be ruled out. I'm sure we're going to see a lot about that. But this was not a protected crime scene in the least, because of the amount of individuals who were in and around it.
Mm-hmm.
And even law enforcement. I mean, there were a lot of law enforcement officers that went up and through that scene.
Yeah.
And before the state crime lab came and were able to do their job. I also found it interesting that they came back, I believe it was January 6th. What some people might not know is once you give your inventory, which they did on FD-597s, in huge parts of this case, but it doesn't matter. Once you do a warrant and then you submit your inventory, you're not allowed to go back without a secondary warrant.
Mm-hmm.
Yet I saw on January 6th, they went back and apparently it was because they missed some things. Blood on, I think it was a piece of furniture and other things. I mean, they took all sorts of things out there on January 6th,
mm-hmm.
which is such a delay, really, from the initial moments that they were there and were extracting information. I always thought that was problematic, Tony. You know, maybe it's just the FBI supervisor thing going, but, you know, y'all knew when you went into a search warrant situation, a scene like this, you better get everything while you had care, custody, and control of it. Once it was relinquished, even though I understand it was protected, once it was relinquished, you know, you don't want to have to go back again and again, and you want to do the job right the first time.
Yeah.
That kind of bothered me, Tony. I'm going to be honest with you.
Yeah, no. Were you surprised the digital evidence or lack thereof of digital evidence? What we heard officially is that he wiped it. I mean, that's been the excuse. I mean, we hear so many stories where people wipe their data, but it still is retrieved. Was he just a step or two ahead where he really did wipe it to the extent where, you know, nobody could get it back? Or was there just not the data there to begin with?
He was 10 steps ahead, Tony. I tell you, I just watched another interview of the current police chief, and he talked about how he wiped it as he went.
Mm-hmm.
He said words to that effect. So you're talking about, you know, whatever he searched, then he would probably erase that archive. And he also, they were very specific that he had particular software, you know, programs to erase. And I can tell you from all the training I've gone through on this, it is hard to erase your digital footprint for your average Joe.
Yeah.
But there are programs you can purchase. We go over them all and, you know, study that, that people can purchase and do to wipe their digital footprint. Really, the only thing they found in his phone, Tony, and this was another, you know, thing we've learned, they found some corroboration. In other words, what they already knew, they were able to corroborate with things. They found a couple of searches about the incident, you know, looking up news information, obviously the selfies that we've seen, but very little other than that. And so when people say that there was absolutely no interaction with Kaylee or Maddie or any of them, and that there was nothing that he did. In other words, for instance, was he the guy in the woods and did he take any pictures? Mm-hmm. We'll never know it because it's wiped. If the FBI can't get it, it's not gettable. And for people who think that when you erase it, it can't disappear. It can if you do the proper steps and have the proper software.
There are ways. Yeah. Without a doubt, if you know what you're doing, you could erase your digital footprint if it's on a native device by you. If it's out to the cloud, then you got a few more problems going on. But if he kept everything really, really close to the vest, there's a lot of ways that he could have easily gotten away with it. And it appears that he did. What, I mean, this is just, you know, purely theoretical, but had this thing gone to trial at some point without the digital footprint, you got the DNA, that's pretty damning, without a doubt. And I don't want to, you know, poo-poo that by any means, but there was a lot of things I thought, most of us thought we were going to see. We were going to see some sort of relationship or some sort of attempt at a relationship on Koberger's part to communicate with one of these victims or something. But none of that would have been there. How strong of a case would this have been had it gotten to a jury?
I still think it was really strong. They had all of that video surveillance of his vehicle and all those different times in and around that house. Even the police stop that they recently released where he admitted not having his seatbelt on. He gets a $10 ticket.
Yeah.
And then he does the Columbo at the end. Right. For those old enough to remember Columbo, he'd be all done with his questioning. And then he'd turn around and ask the important question. Mm-hmm. And so he turns around and Columbo's the officer. And he says, by the way, did you even know I didn't have my seatbelt on? And the officer, you could tell, is so young and so rookie, kind of giggles and says, no, I didn't even look.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, he told on himself. Right?
He did. He did. Because I believe he says in that video, I'm just trying to be honest.
I know. He has no problem being honest when he knows they've got him.
Yeah.
Right? He knew about radar, and then he figured the cop had seen it, and that's why he was being asked. He gave the cop way too much credit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in this case, he knew he was nabbed. He couldn't get out from underneath it. You also have the fact he purchased that K-bar knife. They had that down. That doesn't make any sense. You also have just the fact that he turned his phone off during that 2 hours. I think that is so incriminating.
It is.
You have all the driving he did, the fact he came back at 9 o'clock, 9:30, I think it was, to look for the sheath in case he dropped it on the way out and to say, what in the heck? Why isn't this place crawling with police?
Mm-hmm.
And then I could just see himself going, thumbs up, man. I got away with this. I did this perfectly. I think he would have been convicted. The bigger question for me is, boy, if that DNA would not have been, you know, if he wouldn't have left the knife sheath, I don't know if he would have ever been convicted.
Or caught, for that matter. You look at some areas where maybe he would have been with the car, they might have narrowed that down, but convicted? I don't know. I don't know about that. I think the scary prospect is it might have taken until another, you know, incident, incidents putting it lightly, another massacre before he got caught, if he found a way to flub that up. I don't know. There's a lot of questions as to what if, but we all do now know who it is and who is behind bars. So that will be a win for law enforcement at the end of the day. So let's recap here what we're really walking away with. Not just a confession-free conviction, but a case that almost didn't come together at all. If Brian Koberger doesn't leave that knife sheath behind, what are we looking for? A white Elantra? Spotted on grainy security cams? A guy who turned off his phone for 2 hours in the middle of the night? That's not nothing, but it's not always enough. And if the digital trail really is gone, if there was never a text, never a Google search, never a photo taken, it's not just discipline. That's premeditation with a forensic awareness level that most offenders never come close to pulling off. Then there's the scene itself. A crime that messy should have given us more. Sweat, hair, skin cells, maybe even fingerprints left behind in the chaos of the struggle. And yet, almost nothing. Why? Because maybe he was covered up. Maybe the scene just wasn't preserved the way it needed to be. Either way, once friends started walking through blood, once someone literally picked up a knife and put it back down, the chain of custody had already begun to fray. And once that happens, you don't just lose evidence, you lose certainty. Jennifer laid it out in terms only someone with field experience can. This wasn't a clean crime scene. It was a vulnerable one. And the fact that investigators had to go back nearly 2 months later with a second warrant to collect blood off furniture, that's not ideal. That's a breakdown in protocol. One that could have jeopardized the whole case if the DNA link hadn't been so strong. But maybe the biggest takeaway here isn't about what they found. It's about what Koberger erased. The selfie smugness, the empty devices, the deliberate use of deletion software. That's the chilling part. Not that he left so little, but that he planned to leave nothing. In the end, law enforcement got their man, but it's fair, more than fair, to ask how close they came to missing him and what would have happened if that knife sheath had never hit the floor. Because justice here was served, just barely, and that should scare all of us just a little. Let me know your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. If you're not there already, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi so you can find us there. You can also do that same search wherever you download podcasts so you can take us on the go as well. Let me know your thoughts in the comments section, and please do press subscribe. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon. Okay. Now over to Devil 1, and I may have labeled them both Devil 2, but this is Devil 1, Devil's Den Attack, Planned for Years, is the title. There's planning a, again, 3, 2, 1. There's planning a hike, and then there's planning a hunt. And what we're about to get into here, this was no random act, no spur-of-the-moment snap. This was a deliberate, intentional act, a predator setting the stage for prey. On today's episode, we're diving into one of the most chilling conversations we've had yet, a detailed behavioral analysis of the man now accused of the brutal double homicide at Devil's Den State Park. Joining me is retired FBI Special Agent Jennifer Coffendaffer, who pulls no punches when it comes to unpacking the predator mindset and the disturbing indicators that this attack may have been in the works for years. Andrew McGann didn't just wake up angry. He left his house dressed for murder, with tape on his license plate and a tactical-style backpack that Coffendaffer believes was pre-packed with tools for the kill. It's not a guy going for a nature walk. That's someone on a mission. When you hear what she thinks he was actually hunting, not the parents, but the children, you start to see just how twisted this whole thing might be. We're going to talk trial psychology, predatory fixation, what this guy's behavior on the path tells us about his previous patterns, and whether law enforcement should be looking into more than just this one horrific incident. And if you thought it couldn't get darker, oh, it does. Because this same man was about to start a new job as an elementary school teacher. We're going to get into the systematic breakdown that allowed Andrew McGann to leapfrog from one school district to another, each time leaving behind a trail of accusations and red flags that somehow never made it into his official record. That sounds like a recipe for disaster. It is. And this might be the wake-up call we've been ignoring far too long. So how does a teacher with a growing reputation for weird and possibly predatory behavior end up in charge of children year after year until he snaps and ends up at Devil's Den? Let's get into it. And the out. 3, 2, 1. What we're looking at here isn't just the story of one monstrous act on a quiet trail in Arkansas. This is a cautionary tale of how predators navigate through our blind spots, the loopholes, the paperwork gaps, the institutional shoulder shrugs. Andrew McGann didn't just fall through the cracks. The system laid down a red carpet for him. From Texas to Oklahoma to Arkansas, a trail of warning signs followed him. Complaints, suspicion, discomfort, all of it handled internally and quietly swept aside so he could move on without a blemish. And each time he landed in front of another classroom full of kids, That's what should really keep us up at night. What Jennifer Coffendaffer laid out here is more than criminal profiling. It's a diagnosis of a system failure. A man like McGann doesn't build a life around children without intention. You don't earn a degree specifically in elementary education, pass through certification checks, and stick close to the youngest, most vulnerable students unless you have a reason. And the fact that this reason slipped past the very institutions meant to protect those kids, that is unacceptable. Let's be honest, this isn't just about Arkansas or even just about Devil's Den. This is about every school district that's ever looked the other way. Every administrator who thought, let's just have him resign. Every policy that allows whispers to be blurred in filing cabinets and buried instead of reported to someone with a badge. This is a national problem, one we are calling out loudly, right here and right now. So what happens next? Well, lawmakers in Texas have already finally started closing the loopholes with legislation designed to stop this exact kind of pass-the-trash behavior. But it's too late for the Brinks family, and it doesn't change what happened on the trail. It's going to take a lot more than a few good bills to fix what's broken. It takes people like Jennifer, like you, like me, asking the hard questions and refusing to let this kind of institutional negligence stay hidden in the fine print. If you're still listening, ask yourself this: who's watching your district? What red flags are quietly sitting in someone's desk drawer? Because an ex-McGann might already be out there. And this time we don't get to say we didn't see it coming. Tell me what your thoughts are in the comments section on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi to find us. Do the same search on any podcast platform to find us there so you can take us on the go wherever you are going. Please let me know your thoughts in the comments and press subscribe so you don't miss any of our coverage on this case and the many we cover for you right here. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com. This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com. This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com. This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com. This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com.